and Kulam and all those good things. Plenty of magic and superstition.
And where did this fascination with, superstition and all those, worldly things come into, your mindset?
Yeah, I'm sure I'm not the only one who had a mother who enjoyed scaring her children into being good. And my mother's favorite way of doing that was using the aswang. She also called my dad an aswang, and that's a totally separate thing. But she told me that the aswang would come and eat me. Obviously, that's not the case now. Would eat me if I misbehaved. But then as I got older, she told me that she knew a real family who were being accused of being a aswang in Karigara. And from there, it was just like this really fascinating thing where she told me these unique rules that I hadn't heard of. And also the persecution that this family went through because they were being accused of being like these ghoulish creatures. And eventually that family got pushed out of Karigara. They changed their name. Some of them moved to Florida, actually, where we're still friends. But it really cemented my fascination with like how potent these monsters can be, both in fiction and in real life.
And in your book, it's set in 1986 during a very turbulent time in the Philippines. It's the election between Marcos and Cory Aquino, or Ferdinand Marcos the first or senior. And it's the time of the People Power Revolution. Why did you feel like this was an important, time and space to set your story in?
Yeah, I genuinely believe the People Power Revolution is one of the most fascinating and powerful times in human history. And it is such a sad thing that not many people know about it. When I went to college, I focused my studies on Filipino politics. And then eventually, when I was in law school, I worked in the Security Exchange Commission in Manila. And there I really got to have like a sort of more bird's eye view on the political situation and how it affects people from the ground up to the very top. And also I began to see like Duterte rise. I saw the political climate in the United States change. And I saw many parallels between these two countries. So it really inspired me to bring everything I could about the People Power Revolution into this book. And I included radio transcripts and interviews and as much real life into it as I could.
And in your book, I believe the main character's name is Josefina. And she's going through a transitional time in her life when this plot takes place. What's happening in her life at this moment in your book?
Yes. So Josephine is actually, her family was the victims of a political massacre, and it is actually based on a real political massacre that didn't happen in Leyte, but like in Mindanao. And I wanted to showcase the unique place that women found themselves in the 1980s, where you have so much freedom, like you're educated, but there's still this very strong societal expectation that you marry and you have kids and you kind of stay at home and do what's best for your family no matter what. And my mother did that herself. She got married a little earlier than she wanted to. She went to the United States because she believed it was best for her. And I really wanted Josephine to be able to choose her own future, which she did by going into this house and playing this very deadly game.
And in the course of the plot, she reconnects with a friend, which really ties into the whole monstrous element of this book. What can you tell us about how you weave this character and this plot theme into your book?
Yeah. So Pariah was honestly, in some ways, a bit of a self-insert. She was so many of my like younger insecurities, my fear of kind of being pushed into roles that I didn't want to be in. Like, I didn't initially want to be a lawyer, but I did so because it pleased my mother. And my mother naturally chose to do some things that she didn't want to do because it pleased her mother and so on and so forth. And so it's this, she's sort of like a symbol of a generational sacrifice that I think many of us are familiar with, whether you're male or female. And by choosing to reject what society and her family expected from her, she becomes monstrous. And she also happens to be in a swong. So it's kind of a double whammy there.
And you've brought up the word aswang for our listening audience and those who will be eventually watching the stream of this. What is an aswang for those that do not know?
Yes, of course. I'm sorry. An aswang is, well, it depends on who you ask. Some people have this idea that it's like a manananggal. It's like a beautiful woman who like separates from her bottom half, and she goes and she uses this long proboscis to puncture the roof of a thatched house to suck out an unborn baby from a sleeping mother. Some people believe that it's an aswang is more like a creature that goes and digs up fresh graves and eats bodies. And then in Karigara, it was more like a shapeshifter who could eat babies, but was also more of a witch, someone who could curse people or even help you, but was more likely to curse you.
And for our listening audience out there, we have author Daphne Fama, who is the author of House of Monstrous Women. I think many people out there who are not Filipino might not be aware of the mythological witch culture that the Philippines has, that for a country that's predominantly, I guess, Catholic and has from the Moors, Islam, that people kind of forget that this before colonization, that there was other things going on in this country. And so you see the weirdness sometimes of how Catholicism and I guess for all intents and purposes, I guess voodoo type of things, where they have like this weird relationship where it's just, because there's things that you believe in the Catholic faith, and then there's things where you're like, well, I'm not going to go against this, where if I see that duende or something, that midget person in the tree, I can't look at them, or something's going to happen to me. That did you get fascinated when you learned more about this subculture of the Philippines?
Oh yes, I mean absolutely. Like I like the duende and like the tapi tapi po and staying away from baleti trees. Like it's all really fascinating. But in the pursuit of writing this book, I actually I go to the Philippines every year because my mother runs a medical mission, and during the course of that, I was able to visit like several healers who use, as you said, like Catholic faith. They invoke saints to heal people. But it's definitely combined with more like pre-colonial practices, like very nature-based. But then I went to Durham Island, which is just north of Karigara, and I met with someone who practices a type of like black magic called Bulan. And he, I think, was the closest I've ever met to someone who practices like true pre-colonial Filipino magic. He says he actually had a deal, according to him, with an Encanto. And the Encanto killed his wife and two children in order to give him this power. It was an exchange. And then after that, he began to gain abilities that allowed him to kill people. And he would show me pictures of people he killed. And he charged people around $300, or maybe that's what he would charge me because I'm a foreigner. And he would put their photo in an iron pot, take it to a graveyard, and then boil it every Friday until that person died, which is just insane work. And my mother was naturally terrified of me telling him his name or drinking anything there because it was the belief that he poisoned me. But it was just a really fascinating experience. And it's great to see that people, even if it's, I guess, to harm, that there's like these beliefs that are still out there in the Philippines if you really, really look hard for them.
I think it's a new experience for, say, people like ourselves who either were born in the United States or people that were raised in the United States to go back to the Philippines, because I think there's almost a heightenedness of being on guard but being aware of your surroundings, because they think that there might be some naiveness about how you deal with these stories. Yeah. or being around certain areas. You talk about how you've gone back to the Philippines, I guess more often than not, because of medical missions with your mother. Has from her experiences now and you going there, have things changed for the betterment, do you think, for women?
Gosh. Oh, I mean, yes, definitely. I think for women, things have really changed positively. At least in Karigara, it went from a place of there was no electricity. My parents' house was really quite poor. But now Karigara is almost like a bustling city and there's plenty of schools. And I think it's, you know, it's still hard, isn't it? I think women's medical health is something that's a little bit lagging behind. Or maybe I'm just exposed to it more because of my mother's work. But there's definitely, I feel like women are very empowered in the Philippines. They work hard. They're very educated. They are so clever and they really want to change the world. Like, I'm constantly being inspired by the women I meet there. And I think that if my mother had been born in this era, the course of her life would be so different. So it has definitely improved. But I think, of course, no matter what country you're in, we always have a ways to go.
And I think what makes almost you the perfect writer for this kind of story is that based on the bio that I've read about you is that you grew up in the South. And mm-hmm. as we talked about, like, voodoo culture and mythological stuff, yeah. I mean, we just have this Ryan Coogler movie, I think Sinners, where I believe they talk about that kind of stuff. And I believe his wife has some Filipina descent on her mm-hmm. side that for someone to talk about this kind of story, a Filipina and then a Filipina growing up in the South. What sort of things on the South in terms of like the supernatural that did you kind of deal with over there?
No, there's definitely mountain magic, right? Like, I'm near the Appalachian Mountain. And there was this belief that if you go out at night, you do not whistle, like, because you might lure something to you. Or if you hear something at night, your dogs are going crazy, you don't open the door. And there's definitely belief that like older women can look at you in a certain way and it'll curse you. I think it's honestly really, really fascinating. And I wish there was even more on it because that type of voodoo magic or mountain magic is definitely falling to the wayside. So it's nice that Sinners kind of shone a spotlight on it. And it's something I love to research even more, honestly.
From reading your bio or what the bio I've been told about you, I mean, you're a first-time author. It says that you've been a journalist. It mentions some sort of gaming thing, what may or may not have some relevance to this interview. Yeah. And immigration lawyer. What about immigration is obviously, I guess, a lightning red-hot question these days. What about immigration made it ideal for you to, you know, to pursue law in that?
No, to be honest, it was just growing up, seeing my mother and father in the kitchen filling out thousands of forms to slowly bring my Lola and Lolo to the United States, and my aunts and uncles and the entire family. And, you know, it's sometimes the process for Filipinos is really long, isn't it? Like, it's very difficult to get people over. And unfortunately, a form mishap where my grandfather died before the last sibling, like the last daughter, could get here, like, it could have been altered. We could have brought her here if we had known what to do at the time. And so I became an immigration lawyer because obviously I wanted to help my family. But because there's a lot of families in similar positions, honestly. And, you know, I'm really interested in asylum law and humanitarian law and nonprofit law. And so all of that kind of intersected.
It's crazy when you speak about immigration because there always seems like there was weird double standards. I mean, yes, Filipinos were able to benefit out of their if they were in the military in World War II and to come to the States, but then you see how children who are born from American soldiers probably have a harder time than kids that were born during the Vietnam War of coming over here. So I always think it's I think, unfortunately, not everybody is as well-versed as they should be with immigration because I know my mom telling her brothers and sisters when she immigrated to the country that, let me petition you guys. And I think back then it was 5-7 years, and now I hear it's like in the 20s before a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, I mean, that's two, you're affecting potentially two generations of family.
100%. And like the expectation is like, oh, you can't get married like legally while you're in the Philippines, while you're waiting for your petition. And I just kind of think it's a little unfair because all the Filipinos I've ever met who come to the United States have only like, they want to like work in the medical field. They want to be teachers. They want to contribute to the community. Like they are like some of the most upstanding U.S. citizens I've ever met. Like they really are here for like all the right reasons. And they really want to just change the trajectory of their life. So it sucks that it is, as you say, it takes two generations for that to happen. And they had to put their lives on hold. It's a little unfair, honestly, if you ask me.
Well, you're on the show, obviously, because you wrote this book, A House of Monstrous Women. I mean, on some degree, you had to put your life on hold to write a book.
Oh, yeah.
What is that process like? Like, what kicked you in the butt to say, you know what, this is something I honestly want to do?
Yeah, no, I think I'm at a really, I'm at an interesting crossroad where I was like, if I don't do it now, I might never do it. And, you know, it took a lot of like long hours at night, awkward hours, honestly, and being willing to accept a lot of rejection and no one really kind of believing in me until like the proof was in the pudding, like I got a deal. It was honestly really hard, but it is possible. And I'm particularly lucky that I don't have children yet. And so I was able to eke out a little bit more time than mothers. But I know mothers can do it too, if you really set your mind to it and you really take advantage of like what little periods of time you have.
And in your book, it talks about Haraya's home, the Renoko house, where it's near the sea, and there's a labyrinth within this,
yeah,
this house. From your like research or writing this book, has there always been some sort of uniqueness when it comes to I guess the supernatural in homes in the Philippines?
Don't you think so? Like whenever you're in the Philippines and you see those old houses, like they almost always have a ghost story associated with them, right? Like it's like, oh, the Japanese were there and it was a prison or it was like a hospital. I just find them to be like really kind of creepy half the time, even if they're very beautiful. But then I was also really inspired by Intramuros, which has tons and tons and tons of ghost stories. And I think, honestly, the Philippines has so much history. A lot of it's kind of because of so many periods of colonization, bloody history. So like these houses that are decades old, they have the impression of that dark history on them. And it's hard to kind of separate it from that. So yeah, I would definitely say there's definitely some sort of, how did you say it? Like a kind of like haunting within homes.
No, you have me a little stumped here. In regards to, in terms of the supernatural and what you're trying to say in the book, are there around your research, are there other people that also write stories of the supernatural from fiction from the Philippines?
You know what? Yes, you know, I actually am going to, like, have the concept. But there is Victor Maripo, and he's Filipino. He used to do sci-fi, but now he has a gothic horror set in the Philippines coming out, and I'm so excited, honestly. Let me find out the release date. Sorry, I know this is, like... gosh... Oh, it's Dead Note. Okay. Yeah, it's called Dead Note. And it's a thriller in Manila. Thriller in Manila. You know what I mean? Oh, actually, it's out now. Yeah. So I would really suggest that. If you really want kind of like a Filipino horror thriller, Victor Manibo, definitely look him up. Dead Note, because he's a fantastic writer. He's born in Manila in the Philippines, and he came here, and he's actually a lawyer as well in New York. So,
as you lawyers, I got a lot of thoughts in your mind there, besides the law.
Yeah, I'm curious. We're always like, what's the spookiest thing I can think?
Well, there's definitely, from what I can tell, there's definitely a fascination with, in general, I guess mainstream society with Filipino culture. I mean, you have Netflix who does a Tagalog and English version of a graphic novel, I believe. Starts with a T. It should have.
Oh gosh, is it? I think I actually have a physical copy of it. I'm so bad with names. Is it like the one where there's like a bunch of mythological creatures?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, I bought some comics literally last year from them. Oh, I'm trying to find out what it is.
But definitely, I mean, I think there's always been this fascination with our culture when it comes to the supernatural, because it's, as much as it may be something you don't always talk about, surprise, surprise, it's like, don't touch the hot stove, you are fascinated about, because you want to know about something that you aren't necessarily familiar with. And
yeah, no, I agree. I mean, maybe it's because I was born in the United States, as you said, but like when I go to the Philippines and I see, like, it's such a beautiful country with so much history, and like you have these deep jungles and these dark oceans, it's so easy to imagine like what could be out there. And knowing that my ancestors asked the same question and they came up with all these interesting answers, like Serena and the Duwindi, as you said, and like the Wak Wak and the Manananggal. It's a really fascinating history that I honestly can't resist.
I think the one thing that that people kind of forget about when it comes to the Philippines is there's also a lot of history that may have been lost because of settlements along the ocean. And so you have artifacts that a typhoon happens. Yeah. And a lot of our history sometimes is it's oral history. And the influence that our people have from being maybe some of the first sailors, even before the Vikings, or some of the plants that are not indigenous to our lands, because I think our people have a curious mind in regards to things. Yes. In regards to that thing that we were talking about, I believe it's called Trece on Netflix.
Oh, Trece. Okay, cool. Oh, I'm so bad with names. It's a great comic, honestly. It's really fun.
After are you doing any sort of book tour for your book?
Yeah, I have to. I actually was at a conference yesterday, but I'm going to do some bookstore signings. I think we have two scheduled so far, one in North Carolina, where I was born, and one in Michigan, where I am at now.
Do you plan to, in the future, continue some other writing?
Yeah, I was signed up for a 2-book deal with my imprint. And the next one is also going to be set in the Philippines. And it's going to be kind of midsummer Wicker Man inspired, with like more a Filipina, like a fiesta vibe. And there's going to be a Diwata and plenty of spooky folklore, very much baked into it.
And when we come towards the end of our interviews with our guests, we like to keep it a little more lighthearted in terms of the questions at the end. As we stated earlier, you did grow up in the South, and you're also Filipina. What are your favorite Filipino and Southern dishes?
Oh God. Okay, look. you have to say your mom's adobo, right? Like, you gotta say it because you know she's gonna find you. But honestly, God, I have some really, you know what I really miss? It is these type of, actually, I'm going to like pause for a second. I'm so bad with names, Alan. Please don't include this in the podcast. Do you remember this like white, like bread that you have to cook within like banana leaves, and it's cooked on bottom and on top, and it has to be done like with like stones, I think.
Oh gosh, you're really.
I
probably know what it is, but it's like visually, I would have to see it. But it's
yeah. I'm going to find it because that actually is my favorite food. I'm so sorry. It starts with a T. Rice bread. Oh, I'm so sorry. I should just say adobo and end it there. Okay, I'm just going to say adobo.
Okay, we'll go with adobo.
Yeah, and then of course, you know, I love hush puppies. Is that too silly to say?
No. It's what you like. It's not what I like. So
yeah, I guess that's true. You're right. There's no wrong answer. I love hush puppies. And I feel like I can't find them anywhere else.
If that's what your palate likes, that's what your palate likes.
I feel like there's some judgment there. Okay, what's yours?
No judgment. I like bistik.
Okay. Yeah, very good.
What else do I like?
Minnesota classic.
I like a Minnesota classic. What do I like? Well, here at our Minnesota State Fair, a local teacher gained notoriety because she makes these chocolate chip cookies called Sweet Martha's cookies. So people go gaga buying buckets of cookies that also help to go fund, you know, some of the students of, like, that she has a lot of students that are her volunteers or work for her there. So it's a big thing. Like, you can go on the internet, go like on YouTube and like Food Network stuff, be like Sweet Martha's cookies, and people will go gaga over Sweet Martha's cookies.
I bet it's so filled with love. I have a new food for the Filipino one. My mom used to make me champurrado.
Okay.
And then she would put these tiny little salted fishes in it. And we'd have to like completely like cover like the bottoms of every door in the house with towels to stop the smell from sinking into everything. Yeah. So honestly, I haven't had it in years, but I have such good memories of that. That's it. That, and I think honestly, Martha's cookies sound better than hush puppies. So,
do you have any go-to karaoke songs?
I know I'm ashamed to my country when I say I cannot sing. I have two left feet. And I can't sing.
Wow, you sing well. Hey, but I guess you write eloquent stories, so.
Thanks.
Thank you. So you don't have to tell your stories via dance movement or song.
Yeah, I'm out there with a tambourine doing this. I'm just excited to be there.
And maybe our last question for the night of doing all this research on supernatural things. What's maybe a supernatural Filipino folklore thing that you've heard about that not everybody heard about that might intrigue people?
Okay, I have a really cool one. There's a type of like black magic that involves insects, but they're like insects that are made by like a malevolent black wind, and they have like devious intelligence. And you know that they're the right type of insect if they have six legs. And to use them, you'll put them in a bamboo tube, and then you'll ask them if they're willing to assassinate someone for you. And then if you put a little stick in there, and if they come out, they're willing to do it. And then they'll like go into a person's orifices, including their butt, to create these illnesses in them. And it's meant to be like a really subtle way of killing someone. And I have not seen anyone else ever mention that, these butt insects. So I think that's really interesting.
And before we end the show, where can our listeners and viewers find information about yourself and the book?
Well, I have a website called DaphneFarma.com, but House of Monstrous Women will be available at every major retailer on August 12th and in the UK on August 14th. So just a little Google search and you should hopefully be able to find it, and please pre-order it.
Thank you for your time tonight, Daphne.
Thank you so much, Alan.
Well, that went well.
Oh, it was so fun.
I'm not sure how good I'll be good at editing out the pauses. I think it will add to the naturalness of the interview. Yeah.
This is Sound Effects, a radio playground, a compendium of radio theater, comedy, and the audio arts.